Thank you. Just to start off, these are truly extraordinary times. I don't have to tell people that we are in the midst of two major crises. The first is a crisis of capitalism, you know, a real crisis of capitalism. Maybe not the final crisis of capitalism, but we actually don't know how far it's going to go. And the second is a crisis of nature, a crisis, an environmental crisis, a crisis about the biological basis of life. And these two crises are coming together to limit the options of capitalism to improve itself and to breed conflict and social conflict. So in some ways, we're living in a time where there's a curse upon the land that we've put on it. And in the words of Alice Walker, only justice will stop a curse. And that is the question, whether that's in the cards today. So what we have now is this crisis without a movement. It's the wet dream of all leftists, a crisis of capitalism, and we don't have it. We don't have the movement yet to respond to it. And I've written a book about a period when we had a movement without a crisis of capitalism. I mean, when capitalism could still deliver the goods, not to everybody, not without entailing brutal, horrible wars, torture, deprivation. Many people were left out, but many people still, to the majority in this America, it could deliver the goods, and it delivered the goods to the organized working class, which was not part, largely, of that movement in that period. And in between the 60s, that period of a movement without a crisis of capitalism, and now this period of a crisis of capitalism without a movement, we've had a 40-year counter-revolution, a 40-year counter-revolution to a revolution that didn't take place. And we have no sense of how we're going to emerge from that. If ever there was a time now to question the system, and for that questioning to spread through the society, is now. And by the system I mean, and this is what we meant in the 60s, I don't use the word capitalist system. We use just the word system for a reason. Because by it, we meant more than the economic and political institutions by which the rich wave unequal war against the poor, stealing the fruits of their labors, despoiling the earth in the process. We meant the totality of reality as shaped by, dependent upon, and supportive of those institutions. We meant presidents and penises, the phallus, the metaphorical phallus, Pentagon and our parents, desires and disaffections, torturers and toothpaste, and all of that interlinked. It was a great labyrinth that we were trying to get out of, and the labyrinth is another metaphor that I have for this system that we have to break through. The system is a labyrinth, large as the world, containing at its center a devouring monster. The monster is hideous and beautiful. It has the face of death in a body made of love. It has an enormous appetite. It's human and inhuman. It has many names: greed, profit, lust for power. But its secret name is unknown. The monster breaks our bones to get at the marrow, gobbles our hope, sucks us dry of possibilities, reams out our imagination. It is insatiable. And how do we get out of that labyrinth? Is there a thread that we follow? Or do we have to use sledgehammers to break through the walls to create a new exit? That, in some way, is the question of this second time. I had the luck to live through a period that felt revolutionary, where there felt like all across the world there was a great agitation trembling the halls of power. It doesn't exactly feel like that now, not yet. But this is how it felt to me at the time. For a few brief years, we were incandescent. We would burn the armor off the body politic. Naked ourselves, we would grasp the naked truth and live in her embrace. The world was gripped in a vast instability. Geysers were bursting through hard rock. Wounds that never healed were opening. Cleansing waves were washing through the halls of history, jumbling the furniture, tumbling closets full of secrets, freeing those trapped beneath the floorboards. Terrible crimes were being exposed. We would ride the waves. No, we would be the wave, and not just the wave, but the spume at its leading edge. So I played a part, my small little speck of flotsam on this wave was to be part of a group called Up Against the Wall Motherfuckers, or Motherfuckers for short. And the book is a lot about the strengths and the terrible weaknesses of that group. It was described in various ways, an anarchist street gang, although, you know, ideologically, did we spend a lot of time discussing Bakunin and Kropotkin and what happened to the anarchists in Spain and what the Bolsheviks did to them there in the U.S.? No, we didn't do any of that. Were we a gang? Well, you know, we tried to be. We wore leather jackets. We had knives in the back of our pockets. We roamed the street. I was probably, you know, the most least motherfuckerish of motherfucky. In some ways, the closest resemblance, I think, now is the Black Bloc, composed of small affinity groups committed to direct action, reveling in the sound of broken glass, tagging on to big mass demonstrations but chafing at their tameness, breaking away, being a vanguard, at least in their own mind, the risk takers and the target of police paranoia. The difference is that, as I said, we did not identify ourselves as anarchists. We had also an organizing base. We had a base in the community of the Lower East Side, and we had a street community of dropouts that doesn't exist anymore. It's evaporated off the Hayden, evaporated and been driven out of the Lower East Side, but it was there. But more important, it was a different time. It was a time where all over the world there was armed struggle against capitalism. And those armed struggles, for various reasons, are not there anymore. The way I describe us in the book is as follows. We saw ourselves as urban guerrillas swimming in the countercultural sea of freaks and dropouts. We didn't like the media term hippie. That had swarmed to the cheap rent tenements of the Lower East Side of New York. These young dropouts were our base, and we attempted to organize them for total revolution through rallies, free feasts, raucous community meetings, and a steady stream of mimeographed flyers. Against the vapid spaciness of flower power, we proclaimed the need for armed love. Our rhetoric was inflammatory and often violent. We gave speeches and wrote manifestos, but above all, we believed in propaganda of the deed. We engaged in constant confrontations with the police. We would start riots, get arrested, start another one to protest arrests, and get arrested again. And that was largely our life on the Lower East Side of New York. And we went beyond there. It continued that way. We took our name from a poem by, he then called himself Leroy Jones. He now calls himself Amiri Baraka. Poem written during a period of flash uprisings across the country in the ghettos. one after another going up in flames. And the poem is called Black People! Exclamation mark. It is addressed to black people, and it says to them, you can't steal nothing from a white man. He's already stole it. He owes you anything you want, even his life. All the stores will open up if you will say the magic words. And the magic words are... This is a stick-up. That's right. Those are the magic words. And the poem goes on to say, smash the window at night. These are magic actions. Smash the windows daytime, anytime, together, but smash the window. Drag the shit you want from in there. No money down, no time to pay. Just take what you want. The magic dance in the streets. Run up and down Broad Street, niggers. Take the shit you want. Take their lives if need be. But get what you want, what you need. Dance up and down the streets. Turn all the music up. Run through the streets with music. Beautiful radios on Market Street. They're brought there specially for you. Our brothers are moving all over, smashing at the jelly white faces. We must make our own world, man, our own world. And we cannot do this unless the white man is dead. Now, the motherfuckers was mainly white men, but we did not think of ourselves as having jelly white faces, and we did identify with the spirit of us. For jelly white faces, we would say the system, the jelly white system, and there we could entirely agree with the spirit of this poem and the spirit that of the people that it came out of. It combined in its rhetoric a terrible beauty and a terrible violence, the connection there, anger and ecstasy, and all of that we could entirely appreciate. Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Just you wait. This is not without criticism. So we had a brief Mayfly existence, in which we, as I said, did these the demonstrations on the Lower East Side. We participated in a takeover of Columbia University, a sit-in that lasted for 10 days till the police were brought in, beating people out of the rooms. We helped organize the defenses of our building. We were outside agitators coming in. We were going to fight the police. We greased the stairs of the building. We had furniture up on casters so at a moment we could have it come crashing down on them as they came in. All of that, in fact, though, although in other buildings everybody got pretty well beaten up, partly by the time they got to us, I think they saved us for last, and basically they were exhausted and we got out without a whole lot of problems. The Secretary of State then was a guy named Dean Rusk. He had a big celebration in his honor at the Hilton Hotel in New York. One of those highbrow affairs. We went to the butcher shops on the Lower East Side. We got our bags of cow's blood. We filled balloons with them. We went to the demonstration, and as the lords and ladies got out of their limousines, we threw our bags of blood at them and splattered their evening gowns and tuxedos. We went to the Democratic Convention. Some of us, I gave inflammatory speeches sufficiently to have myself named an unindicted co-conspirator in the Chicago conspiracy trial of Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Bobby Seale, etc. We had a memorable confrontation with Bill Graham, who started here. His career is the involved with the finances of the mime troupe. But went on basically to become, as everybody knows, big entrepreneur, making a whole hell of a lot of money off what we thought the counterculture, not giving it back. We thought he opened an analog to the Fillmore here, the Fillmore East on 2nd Avenue. we confronted him and said, hey, Bill, you're going to have to give a free night to the community because the folks down here can't afford your ticket prices. He said, over my dead body. We said that could be arranged. He brought out three silver bullets, not silver, regular bullets, that he said had been given him by the Hell's Angels. And he said, well, the Hell's Angels didn't intimidate me, and I'm not going to be intimidated by you. And we said, well, we don't know about the Hell's Angels, but we're going to get what we want. And we did. There was a benefit at the Fillmore East put on by the Living Theater, Julian Beck and Julian Molina. They put on Paradise Now, you know, which is, you know, got a lot of nakedness and the streets, you know, flowing off the stage. And at the end of it, we said we were going to stay there. And we had our free nights. They were total chaos. We loved them. Till eventually they were going to close down the Fillmore, and that was over with. We went up to Boston to called there by some the freaks who were living on the commons up there, who were being attacked by regularly at night by vigilantes. We got into a confrontation of our knives against baseball bats with the Marines. I cowered, and in which actually Ben Morea, probably the charismatic leader of the group, was arrested and charged with attempted murder. He eventually got up. So that we lived this life, but finally, our rhetoric began to catch up with us. The violence of the rhetoric caught the attention of the authorities. But more than that, the Lower East Side was changing. The counterculture changed. It became more somber, more shadowy. The drugs changed. They went from, you know, really good acid to not very good heroin. And real gangs were moving into the Lower East Side. There were biker gangs coming in. They wanted to challenge up. They ended up largely killing each other. But we decided it was time to go, and we went to New Mexico and evaporated there in New Mexico. And we were a bit early in this. This was 69, 70. But the movement, largely that great wave that I talked about, sank into the sands, largely into the sands of this counter-revolution. Not completely. I mean, many movements were spawned by it, the environmental movement, feminist movement, and so on. The culture changed, but power did not change. The basic structure didn't change. So I've written about this period. I mean, it's a memoir of this period, but it is not a romanticization of it. It's largely, in fact, a confession of some of what was hidden, some of the ways in which the movement became a mask in some ways and hid its weaknesses. And it's about the dangers of not acknowledging some of the hidden realities in our movement. And one of those dangers, I think, which may still be relevant, is the danger of the unconscious acceptance of failure. The unconscious acceptance of the failure, that we will not change society, that we'll rail against it, that we become as a movement like feral cats, shivering in the cold but never expecting to come inside, distrusting the enticements of the domesticated left, committed to direct action even if our civil disobedience is ignored by the press and easily suppressed by the authorities. We become comfortable in our affinity groups, where it becomes easy to talk to ourselves, but we don't talk too much to people outside of it. And many of us, most of us, I'm sure, in this room, shy away from the touch of the electoral system like a plague. We refuse, in that awful phrase, to drink the Kool-Aid. We'd rather remain in the wilderness, true to our vision. We act sometimes I acted, sometimes, maybe this applies also to the black bloc, like rebellious children. And what I say, what I confess about this aspect of the movement, I write about it as follows. Parental authority is writ large in the coercive authority of the state. In challenging the state, it's easy to fall into the role of rebellious child. If society is the parent, and specifically the mother in my case, and we fuck her in anger, we were after all the motherfuckers, or in love, or in some inextricable mix of the two, do we desire to merge with her, to destroy her, or to be destroyed by her? On the surface, our angry, anarchistic, countercultural, take-no-prisoners motherfuckerism was all rage and rejection. But did there lie at its secret core an acceptance of our childishness, a longing for our abusive parent as intense as our rejection of her? Did our politics, despite all our utopian yearnings, betray an inability to imagine taking power from our parent and ending the subordination of childhood? We could always rely on the state to play the role of dominatrix and beat up on her disobedient children. Our politics was a passion play in which the bad parent proved her meanness over and over again to our masochistic satisfaction. Did we secretly identify with the hand that beat us? And I go on to say, I've come to believe that these ambiguities are characteristic of a certain style of predominantly male, radical politics. It's a politics which, however worthy its goals, is self-defeating and infantile in that it repetitively reenacts the relation of child to parent. The parent restrains the child. He throws a tantrum. He beats his little fist bloody against the bars of his crib. He grows up. The bars of his crib become the bars of his prison. He continues to beat his hands bloody. The bars do not bend or even notice. It's easy to dismiss his politics as nothing more than childish tantrums and to profess that a baleful acceptance of the status quo is more, quote, mature. It's more difficult to disentangle delicately, as one would a bird caught in a net, the genuinely radical and uncompromising elements of the politics from those which are self-defeating. So, I'm no longer a motherfucker, way too old. But my politics have been largely motherfuckerish. The sound of breaking glass has blessed me. I like the sight of burning trash cans in the middle of the street and overturned police car. I've believed in direct action. Indirect action has not attracted me. I've seldom engaged in electoral politics or written letters to my congressional representative. But I think there's an intoxication with civil disobedience that's been at the core of my politics, that like all intoxications can lead to an oversimplification of revolutionary practice. It just becomes too damn easy. This is how I describe why I love civil disobedience and what the issues are that I see in it. The key tactic for incorporating the experience of freedom into the struggle for liberation was civil disobedience. When we disobey the authority of the state, there came briefly into existence a space we experienced as a zone of genuine freedom. In everyday life, the forces of repression are omnipresent but generally invisible and unfelt. Violence is held in suspension like droplets in a cloud. Civil disobedience precipitated those forces out of suspension. They arrayed themselves against us and in so doing assumed a definite shape and occupied a definable space. Once that space was defined, we could take our stand outside us. Outside of it, it was liberated territory. And for many of us, and for me, For the first time, I experienced what it meant to be free at precisely the moment that our freedom was taken away from us. In jail, locked behind bars, I felt vulnerable and at peace. So what I write here is that the power of these experiences sustained the civil rights movement and inspired the anti-war movement. They were a gift we cherished, but they were a deceptively simple gift. A movement could not offer people such moments without a means for fulfilling their promise. Once the genie was out of the bag, we did not want to put her back. People could not be convinced to settle for less. The thirst for liberation gave energy but undermined form. Few structures and organizations have survived from the 60s. We never developed a strategy, a political culture, or an organization that could preserve the promise of those moments. Liberation may require, as Gramsci said, a long march through the institutions. The movement will have to defer some promises while retaining its intransigent core. Such a movement cannot be built overnight. We have yet to create a movement that can preserve the molten promise of freedom while tempering it so that it becomes hard and durable. We do not yet have a movement that can bridge the gap, a gap perhaps of generations, between the foretaste of freedom and its realization. We cannot simultaneously shout, freedom now, and freedom not quite yet. And that brings me to where we are, because this is somehow the central issue of our politics in this time, and what raises the issue for us, I can say in one word, a word I don't know how much has been mentioned so far here today, Obama. Precisely when distrust and anger at the system that has brought us to this pass should be at the highest, we have an election of a president who generates a wave of hope, enthusiasm, belief in democratic institutions. And this is totally unfamiliar, and we're so used to having it's a real problem. It would have been a lot easier if he'd lost. That would have been familiar. Then we would be able to continue with this sort of unalloyed contempt for our rulers, expecting nothing of them, railing against them, organizing our little demonstrations, ignored by the media, venting our frustrations on our blogs and websites to titillate ourselves with new discoveries about their atrocities. But here's this guy, this black man, and this enthusiastic, hopeful movement. And we know the limitations. But something has fundamentally changed. It's changed for the better, and that change has strengthened, it seems, the movement, whose strength derives in part from its ability to co-opt and absorb opposition, to engulf it and incorporate it so that it negates its negation. He's not a revolutionary. He's not of the left. He's brought in to save capitalism. He's going to disappoint those who had hopes, unfounded hopes, probably few in this room. He's going to continue the butchery and suffocation of the Palestinian people that Tristan Anderson is paying for at this very moment in a hospital in Israel. He's going to continue the dreadful, senseless war in Afghanistan and the occupation of Iraq. He's going to kowtow to the bankers. Inevitably, disappointment is going to descend on those naive, idealistic believers, desperate for hope, but fooled again, yet again. He'll smile at us, and underneath the table, out of sight, power holds him by the balls and is going to squeeze painfully if he gets out of line. That's all true. And it's also true that what's happened is not insignificant. This was a significant election. It was a choice point for capitalism. There were two possible roads, and one of them was fascism or something fascistic. It stunk of fascism. You know, more scapegoating, more brutality, less willingness to concede anything, violent rhetoric, more repression. You know, all of that, and primarily and above all, a total and absolute disregard for the rule of law domestically and internationally. So that was one. So the other is what we've got. It's sort of like the new, sort of New Dealish, a kind of a liberal democratic alternative that's going to maybe provide some jobs, maybe shore up the safety net, blunt discontent by that. But that choice was not insignificant. I think we didn't do so well organizing under that 40 years of counter-revolution. How well we're going to do now, I don't know. And what shape our movement should have now, I also don't know. But I have sort of this fantasy of what it could be. And that fantasy is that we have a movement that actually prepares for and imagines taking power. Not always being in the position of beating our hands against the bars the way I described. There was, Linda Burnham wrote a really good article, I thought, about what approach to take to Obama. And she cataloged the constituency that he mobilized that put him in power. And she describes it this way. It's African Americans, Latinos, Asians, youth across racial lines, LGBT voters, unionized workers, urban professionals, women of color, single white women, sectors of the labor movement, the peace movement, the civil rights movement, movements for civil liberties, feminists, environmentalists. That is a majority. That's a majority. It's not represented here. This is like white bread, largely. We're white, not jelly white faces, but we're white pretty much here. And this movement is not that. That's a majority, and it's a potentially, possibly, could be mobilized for a revolutionary project. God, we're very far from it. And maybe it requires us to change, and change is painful. It's like we have a political muscle that's locked in. Maybe we need like political chiropractic. It's a choice point for capitalism, but it's also, I think, a choice point for the movement. So in my fantasy, I imagine a movement that would combine direct action in the streets, militant confrontation to wring concessions from the system, programs like the Panthers' Breakfast for Children program that meet the needs of people that the failing state and the economy can no longer meet. And maybe also a movement that engages strategically in electoral politics where candidates genuinely represent the movement and are accountable to it, where we can show that we can actually govern. This movement would have and contain the energy of motherfuckerism, the motherfucker energy, but it would only be part of it. It would be rational and crazy, utopian and hard-headed. It would have roots in the streets, but it would reach into classrooms and universities and the kitchens of welfare mothers and up into the managerial sections of the office. It would reach out to all the exploited, disinherited, disaffected, you know, whatever their disaffections might be. How it's going to be structured, is it centralized or not, how it communicates, I have no idea. But I think it's possible to imagine this movement. It would be a movement that would, I imagine it giving new meaning and taking the words that in the United States people identify with core values, democracy and freedom. And talking about real democracy, democratizing the institutions of the economy, genuinely, so we don't try and have a democratic system with an undemocratic economy. Participatory democracy is what it was called in the 60s in the Port Huron Statement. And freedom, taking back that word. It doesn't mean freedom of capital to go wherever it wants. And it doesn't mean just the freedom of civil rights, the narrow legal constitutional freedoms. It means freedom from want. It means freedom from fear. I think this can be done. The word freedom we should be able to take back, and we should contest for its meaning. And what I say about that word, finally, is as follows. The word expands like a flower, like the succulent prickly bud of an artichoke. It reminds us of intimate longings whose names we have forgotten and collective grief we've taken for granted. It links the language of the law to the language of the heart. It links the practical to the utopian, the personal to the political, earthly struggles to dreams of flying. Its demands are eminently reasonable, and they transcend reason, for its ultimate aim is freedom to romp in the sweet by and by, to throw off all and every fetter, to cast aside the clothing of inhibitions. And in the midst of orgasm, who thinks of politics? But I'm thinking of politics that in fact is orgiastic and holds the promise of orgasm. And I just want to finally end with a poem by Seamus Heaney, that talks, I think, about how I imagine this moment. Human beings suffer, they torture one another, they get hurt and get hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. The innocent in jails beat on their bars together. A hunger striker's father stands in the graveyard dumb. The police widow in veils faints at the funeral home. History says don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So I'm hoping for twice in a lifetime. Thanks. Yeah, definitely questions, if anybody has any questions, thoughts, feelings, concerns. Be voluble, be whatever you want. Yeah.
How do you think a green economy or a resource-based economy can be part of this movement, or is it too in line with capitalism?
See, that's the problem. I mean, that's the Obama problem. I mean, he's talking about a Green New Deal. He just had Van Jones come into his administration. Van Jones is a good guy. I mean, he's talking about it for real. You know, we have to push all of these things that are on the agenda, push them further, push them harder, start in the community. But we can't worry about that idea being co-opted. You know, a green economy, we have to have a green economy. Just because they're talking about it doesn't mean that we reject the idea, you know, as tainted. You know, we start here. You know, we have our houses, our compost piles, or whatever. And if the system doesn't come through with a real green economy, and it can't, as long as it's based on selfish, short-term pursuit of profit, and as long as the banksters are getting away with $1 trillion, that's part of the fight. Yeah. Anything else? Yes, you. Who? What?
I'd like to suggest that just as there are many brands of socialism, there are several possible brands of capitalism. What they call capitalism in Europe is not quite as selfish, and not quite as cruel, and not quite as blind as the capitalism that we have here. And even just now, many people are willing to say what is necessary to save the planet. And by doing that, it will change very deeply the nature of capitalism.
You have just raised one of the central issues that's in front of us. I mean, is there on the agenda now possibly an alternative to capitalism? Can capitalism in the United States and globally become your model in Europe of Sweden and so on, or is what's going to happen? We're going to become more like Indonesia and Burma and all those places where capitalism has, you know, a truly vitally awful, obscene face. I don't know. I mean, there was a slogan in the 60s, in the Paris uprising of 68, be realistic, demand the impossible. That, I think, is still the slogan. You know, it's still the slogan. We don't know how this is going to play out. Maybe the hope of Obama, the hope is that we're going to get a moderated capitalism. It's going to be slightly better. It's going to have more, give more out. We don't know whether that's going to come, but we have to position ourselves to push. And if it means pushing through to something that's not capitalism, then we have to be ready to push there. You know, that's where we have to go, yeah.
Would you care to comment about the system that takes away a person's agency?
It does it in a billion fucking ways. I mean, it does it, I mean, we now know it's not just in the workplace. I mean, the way we are exploited, disinherited, disemboweled in our imagination happens every time we turn on the TV, every time we, you know, we get hooked into their media stuff, every time we become, our needs are satisfied by consumption, not real needs, but manufactured needs, their ability to ream us out, to make us forget our real needs for nature, for beauty, for love, and be satisfied with the flat screen TV or what the latest comes from Apple, the iPhone, you know, what iPhone app do you have? Ooh, I got more iPhone apps than you do. You know, and my iPhone does this and that, you know, and it jumps up and works as a vibrator. No, you know, there's got to be, you know, more to that, you know, but all of those are the ways in which it takes us. That's what I mean. Tortures and toothpaste both are ways in which we are disinherited from our true selves. Yeah. I don't have my watch. I'm not going to look at my watch.
I stopped talking to a friend because I was not going to vote for Obama.
Yeah.
I just got into it, and, you know.
Right.
I'm not going to talk.
Yeah.
There's a problem when those of us who do not want to fix the system in any way feel disrespected by those who insist we must fix the system. There are those of us who see Obama as some kind of hope. There are those of us who see Obama as worse because he is a musical comedy version of a lefty liberal, but he's really a fascist. So we cannot predict the future or what actually turns out to be good. And I get very afraid sometimes here when we're trying to reach out, that what we're doing is stabbing ourselves in the back.
You know, it's exactly the question I'm raising. I would not call him a fascist. I mean, I think he is a liberal Democrat. That may be bad enough for a lot of people here. But I think there really is a difference between Palin and Obama. I've read Dreams for Our Father, and that is not a book that was written by a fascist. But the question that we're going to have to ask, whether you voted for Obama or not, if you don't want to reform the system, what is the strategy from getting from here to there? I mean, is that dichotomy between revolutionary action and reform action a genuine, real dichotomy? Or is it possible that the way towards revolution is by pushing the reform up against the point where the system can no longer deal with it and then pushing further? But when people are involved in movements, most of the movements that we're going to be seeing are going to be movements to demand more from the system, to wring from it concessions. Now, if we are not interested in wringing concessions from the system, then we have to find a way for organizing to get out of our little shell. And I don't know how it is, but maybe one way to do is to say, look, I'll join the movement to wring concessions from the system, but I'm going to join it and be saying, look, this is going to go so far, but it's not going to go further. And at some point, the system's going to have to change much more fundamentally. And maybe with this crisis, where it really isn't able to deliver the goods, and maybe you can't give $1 trillion away to the banks and actually fix this thing, for people. Then maybe that's going to be our opportunity. I don't know. I mean, I work at a legal self-help center. I mean, this is how far we are, you know, from here to there. I work at a legal self-help center. Into that center come every day people with stories about what's happening to them in this crisis. You know, people who were, maybe they were on Main Street, they're slipping into Skid Row. You know, one story after another of desperation. And I told them, I'm trying to deal with them, I'm trying to help them, but I don't have a place where I can say, look, this is the movement that you're going to join. Next door to the self-help center is the Long Haul, an info shop. And the two don't, an anarchist info shop, the two don't connect. They don't connect. And somehow that connection has to happen. When we start talking to the people who are really suffering, I think that's when we're going to get out of this problem of the, you know, this undialectical relationship between reform and revolution.
Yo.
Yo. Yo.
One thing Barack Obama always said in his speeches, whenever he said, I think you heard of it, he always used to say, when he said, it all begins at the bottom. Anybody hear him say that?
Up against what?
It all begins at the bottom.
It all begins at the bottom.
And here we are at the bottom, and for the first time in a long time, we're at the bottom looking up.
All right.
America.
Yeah.
So, OSHA, maybe, you know, we took ourselves seriously.
Yeah, that's right. There's a huge need for all the energy in this room out there to go out and connect up with the level of suffering that's coming down here. I mean, I went out to a demonstration in East Oakland put on by ACORN. ACORN is a reform organization. But it was out in the street. It was in a row of little one-family houses, stucco, all kind of pastel, nice lawns. But that whole street had signs up against foreclosures. And there was a one house with a banner on it and a Latina woman in there with her 8-year-old child. And there was a group out there that was largely neighbors, very few white people, saying, no, the bank is not going to take this house. We are going to keep you in this house. If necessary, we will ring this house. We will go to the banks. Those are the movements we can be part of. Are they reform? Yeah, ACORN's a reform organization, but these are, how can we not be part of those kind of movements? And then people will get to know us and talk to us and see that we, you know, whoever we are, with all the anarchism or utopias in our head, you know, we're real and we're there. You know, with them, and we will go with them as far as we can go. And maybe at some point it will become, they will veer off. I mean, like you fight for workers' wages, the unions fight for worker wages, they get workers up into the middle class, they cease to be revolutionary. That's the risk. That's where we're going to need our strategy. Yeah.
I was just about to ask about that. The hottest thing out there does look like this.
Absolutely.
Rewriting what property is, because it's going right up the food chain. So today's homeless, tomorrow's the next day's, and when we say stop. But we're missing a lot of infrastructure like ride sharing, because they're in parallel, there's Mandalay public transit. And if we can't get to the revolution there, it's not going to be a revolution. So just a lot of that level of stuff.
Absolutely. No, there's so many levels now. And yeah, right. But I mean, out there in East Oakland, among people who never saw an anarchist, never read it, there was an anger at banks. And for the first time in this, you know, reaching deep into the society. I've never seen that, you know, in these 40 years. You know, they're there. We see their faces. You know, these banks. We know that this is outrageous. People are angry that they keep getting, trillions of dollars.
I've got 1 minute.
Well, I'm, you know, okay. Yeah.
50,000 feet in this point there, how many people do you expect to understand what we're talking about here, and what do we do about the rest of it?
See, that's what I think. I think what we're talking about is language that everybody can understand, you know? I mean, ultimately, we can frame, maybe we don't have to have them reading our tracts, but, you know, we can take the word democracy and make it mean something. We can take the word freedom and make it mean something. I don't think there's any reason, you know, for our isolation and our whiteness now. I mean, that, I mean, I'm sorry, you know, that coalition that came together that defeated this 40 years of Republican hegemony, that was significant. We need to look at that. That large coalition can be radicalized. We are not a minority in what we think. We're not. What we are thinking, what we want, what we desire, what our hopes, can be part of the mainstream if we let it.
Is things like environmental degradation and things like that even beyond what Obama could do if he wanted to? In other words, are we at the point where the system can't even do what it wants to do if it wasn't good?
I think we may be there, yes. That's right.
Then the question is, where do we go on that level?
Well, we got to push it. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, I think what we will find out is that, in fact, the system, for all its you know, Van Jones being there, will not be able to deal with the environmental crisis. And we're going to have to push at that point. We're going to have to push for, you know, to wring concessions for the environment, for nature, out of the system. And at the point where it is wrung dry, we have to keep pushing. Thanks.